Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Kick out the jams, motherfuckers. This is Wayne Kramer from the MC5, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
Pantheon Podcasts presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music. Culture. Technology and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
When two tribes go to war, one is all that you can score, diggers. So says the rock and roll archaeologists. Okay. Hey, my friends. Welcome to another edition of Deeper Digs in Rock. Getting close to the big holidays. I will be celebrating each and every one of them with you all. Of course. Like all of us above the age of 12, I have a love-hate relationship with this season. While I appreciate the sentiment and the chance to eat, drink, and be merry with all my peeps, I dislike the commercialization and expectations that also come with this time of year. And I know I'm not alone. In the end, I think it's perhaps the fact that we spend so much time on the extraneous aspects that we tend to forget about the sentiment of the season. So, there, that is my war on Christmas. Well, not so much a war as a lament. I'm not against anything other than spending a ton of money, just because I'm nudged to do so, and that it is blanketed as having more meaning than if I just buy a present at any other time of the year. And I detest the idea that our GDP is dependent on how much we buy between the end of Thanksgiving and the beginning of the new year. Oh, I rent. Therefore, I am. Okay. Hey, guess what? We have another new podcast for all of you to check out. Goldmine Magazine is the leading resource for the record collector who collects new and vintage vinyl records, music memorabilia, posters, and discographies. Goldmine, established in September of 1974 by Brian Bucantis, created an American magazine that focuses on the collector's market for records, tapes, CDs, and music-related memorabilia. Each issue features new articles, interviews, discographies, histories, current reviews on recording stars of the past and present. Discographies are included, listing all known releases. Coverage includes rock, blues, country, folk, and classical. Well, now they have a podcast, appropriately enough, called the Goldmine Magazine Podcast. And it is now on the Pantheon Podcast Network. We could not be more pleased. Hosted by Patrick Prince, who is also the editor of Goldmine, he's had the pleasure to interview many music luminaries already, including Art Garfunkel, Susie Quattro, Dee Snider, Mike Portnoy, Graham Nash, and most recently, the first episode on the network, Rob Halford. He also talks to authors and critics like Robert Christgau and our very own Martin Popoff, as well as spends episodes on events like Record Store Day and the like. Please take a good long listen to Patrick and the Goldmine Magazine podcast and let us know what you think, diggers. Okay, let's get to today's guest.
Well, if you wanted honesty, that's all you had to say. I never want to let you down or have you go as better off this way. For all the dirty looks, the photographs your boyfriend took. Remember when you broke your foot from jumping out the second floor? I'm not okay, I'm not okay.
That was a song that exploded onto the airwaves back in 2004, and, at least to my ears and my memory, pushed an underground subgenre called emo into the mainstream. Emo, and I confess, folks, this is not my strong suit here in the Rock and Roll Academy. Emo, to me, strongly recalls the original glam glitter scene back in the early 1970s, mostly in the UK. And that was basically, of course, my introduction to rock and roll. As most know, I'm a huge Bowie fan from the word go. That's my hero, so that's where it all started for me. Like glam, emo boiled up from an underground scene, gained mainstream success for a brief moment, but kind of died quickly, and it retained a smallish but fiercely loyal following. So, and this is yet another parallel with the glam glitter rock movement, emo didn't really get the acknowledgement and respect until somewhat after the fact. And truthfully, I'm kind of sorry I mostly missed it. I'm kind of experiencing the emo movement in hindsight. But hey, better late than never. And I found a great teacher, someone who really showed this rocker what it was all about. And I'm going to share that discovery with you. With me today is the music writer, Taylor Markarian, who experienced the emo wave of the early 2000s firsthand as a teenage fan, while struggling with her own mental health issues as well as the typical growing pains of adolescence. Taylor found a home in indie, emo, screamo, and eventually heavier genres like metal and hardcore. Taylor Markarian started writing about music at Emerson College in Boston. In 2014, she went to L.A., where she interned at punk icon Brett Gurewitz, you know, of Bad Religion fame, his record label, Epitaph Records. She went back to Emerson in 2015 and finished up her B.A. in writing, literature, and publishing with a minor in music appreciation. She's written for many print and online publications, including Alternative Press, Kerrang, Revolver, Loudwire, and Reader's Digest. Markarian was born in New York City, but was raised and currently resides in New Jersey. And now she has written her first book, From the Basement, The History of Emo Music and How It Changed Society. I think it's fair to call From the Basement the first draft of history for the emo movement in pop and rock music. Taylor's book is colored by her personal experiences growing up with many of these bands in the New York City, New Jersey area. Something I took away from the book, emo bands stay low to the ground and connected to the actual fans who support them. It's really cool, and it's a defining characteristic of the genre. Emo was, and still is, a scene where the fans and the bands really do interact. Emo rockers, by and large, make themselves accessible to their audience. And again, I think that is something to really admire and like about emo. From the Basement is part history lesson, part interview, part oral history. It's raw, passionate, confessional, like emo music itself. So, let's dig in and talk about possibly the last named genre in the history of guitar-driven rock and roll. Time to chat with Taylor Markarian.
Is it worth it? Can you even hear me? Starting with your spotlight on me. Not enough to feed the hungry. I'm tired and I failed before a while now. Oh. This seems lonely. The taste of ink is getting old. It's 4 o'clock in the fucking morning. Each day gets more ambulant. The last day. Still I can see it coming. Walk steady in the river drowning. This could be my chance to break.
Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Taylor Markarian. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Glad to be on the phone. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Yeah, a little coast to coast here. We're out in San Francisco. I think you're over on the other coast, the East Coast, out in the wilds of New Jersey, right?
Yep, deep in the jungle.
Deep in the jungle. So now, the first question, it seems our discussion and your new book are rather timely as we discuss, what's called the emo or screamo genre. In that perhaps the biggest band to come out of that just announced that after 5 years, they are returning. So how excited are you and the fans?
Well, the fans totally broke the internet the other day.
Yes,
the fans
they did, are didn't they? Right.
Totally excited. I would be more excited if they had announced that their first show was in New Jersey or New York, to be honest, because that's where they're from.
Yeah,
that's where I am, but they're playing LA
in Los
first.
Angeles at the Shrine. Yeah, now, so yeah, why do you think they picked that?
I think at least Gerard lives out there now, and it probably just makes most sense from a publicity perspective. But okay.
All right.
Yeah,
he's been working in television. I think he had one of his comic books, The Umbrella Academy, made into a Netflix series this year, right?
Yep, it did. And it's just really nuts that my book happened to come out at the same time or around the same time that, you know, like you said, one of the biggest bands just announced their comeback, and it was totally unexpected.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Yeah, it's you were in the zeitgeist, and I think, you know, you do make a point in the book, and we'll get into this later, but there seems to be a bit of a comeback just in general. I think you were feeling that as you were writing this, and I got that from some of the interviews that you conducted, that you know, maybe it isn't gone forever, that maybe it does seem to be coming back a little bit, huh?
Yeah, you know, honestly, when I started writing the book, I felt like it wasn't, but
it was at its nadir, right?
Yeah, so when I started writing the book and doing these interviews, other people surprised me with their kind of optimism at the future of it, and opened my eyes in a way that, you know, I didn't think emo was going very far either anymore. But like you said, all of these big emo bands are coming back doing their, you know, 20-year anniversary tours, which is making me feel old. And, you know, with the MyChem thing, everybody just seems to be kind of riding a new high on the genre. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, actually, emo wasn't in the cultural consciousness or zeitgeist by itself last week. Saturday Night Live had a skit starring Kristen Stewart that kind of mimicked, you know, an emo, you know, band of the youngsters at corporate America having to grow up and, you know, work their way into management themselves. I know you didn't get a chance to see it because I actually clued you in on that. But there you go. Two events in a week that say, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I know everything. It seems like the pot is stirring a little bit, so I'm excited to see what comes of it.
Yeah, I bet. All right, so tell us about yourself, your interest in music, and emo music in particular, and your professional life.
Well, I first started becoming interested in the emo/screamo genre of music when I was about 13, which that's how I open up the book. I started talking about growing up in New Jersey and what an impact that had on me and introducing me to these bands. And that was really, as you say, ground zero for this movement, if you'd like to call it that. And from there, you know, my passion for that music just carried me through to this very moment, really. I mean, I went to school and I went to Emerson College, where I majored in writing and literature with a minor in music appreciation. So from there on, I was just like, well, I like music. I like to write. So I'm going to write about music. So I started, you know, doing some freelance journalism for publications like Alternative Press and Revolver and Kerrang and Loudwire and all that good stuff.
And I think you worked for Epitaph Records too, Brett Gurewitz's place out in LA.
Yes, I did. I did an internship there under the press department when I was in my last year of school.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. So you have just basically made a career out of your love of music, like the rest of us.
Yeah, you know, I never wanted to be someone who was caught up in a job that they hated. Even as a little kid, you know, seeing parents come home and, you know, talk about how much they hated their jobs, like, that's where you are all day. So why would you choose something that you hate? So, you know, I was always determined to make something out of my love for this kind of music.
That's probably a better way to live. And I've noticed that, you know, you're under 30, right?
I'm 26.
Yeah. So your generation seems to be, you know, looking deeply at that, and, you know, trying to figure out maybe there's a better way, to live than, you know, the corporate culture of, you know, the last century, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely changing. People talk about the side hustle a lot, which, you know, is kind of a term to describe new workers and millennials like myself who, you know, they have their day job, but then they do freelance gigs or side gigs for the stuff that they really love and hope that it gets them somewhere. And I happened to get somewhere.
Yeah, you did. You did. And now you've been able to publish a book. So your dreams are becoming reality.
Yeah, it's pretty unreal, but we'll see where that goes.
Of course, of course. Okay. So now, near the end of the book, you tell us about why this music spoke to you and how it arrived right about the time that you needed it most. It's a brave story, and since I fully agree that sunlight's the best disinfectant, I appreciate your willingness, like your heroes, to write about your real feelings. So can you talk a little bit about your personal experience and how you found your tribe?
Yeah. So in the book, I discuss this genre's influence on and relationship with mental health and things like depression and anxiety and suicidal thoughts and behavior. And you know, not to put it on a pedestal, but as something that really needs to be focused on and discussed in popular culture. And I think that emo was really that catalyst, and people don't give it credit for that. But emo seemed to me to be that artistic catalyst for people to say, you know, like in that famous My Chem song, I'm not okay. And to me, it was a place where I could turn to and hear people saying the same kind of things in their songs that I felt inside but couldn't say out loud. And for me, you know, I was not only a depressed individual, but I did self-harm. And I don't do that anymore, but it was a big part of my life. And it's still something that, even as we talk about depression and anxiety in popular culture and in mainstream media today, self-harm is still something that largely gets ignored or is still treated as taboo, and people don't understand it, which is why I always kind of wanted to tell my own personal story with that. And even though it's hard, I'm glad I did do that with this book.
Yeah, I am too. You know, like I said, sunlight's the best disinfectant. So the more we talk about this, the more normalized it becomes, the more acceptance, the more people can get help without resorting to drastic means. You know, I just think that the more that we can normalize this, not saying that that state of mind should be normal, but at least the cry out for help, and that help should be given when that occurs. And I'm sure you agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of people are either prejudiced against it and biased against people who do that kind of thing because they have no idea what it is and why someone would do that. And I think that a lot of people who may be in the position to help don't have the tools or understanding to deal with that. Like in my circumstance, as you will read in the book, you know, I was kind of attacked by my guidance counselor in middle school.
Yeah.
For self-harming, and that is absolutely the last thing you want to do.
Right.
You don't want to come, you know, with accusations and, you know, mean things to say to someone who's truly hurting and vulnerable and needs help.
Yeah, there's a reason for it. And, you know, it needs to delicately be figured out. And, you know, and to, you know, try to help that person refrain and maybe, you know, get back into a better state of being, right?
Absolutely.
So can I have you explain the organization To Write Love on Her Arms for us?
Sure. Well, my friend Jamie launched it. You can read all about it if you just quickly search it on Google. They have a whole website, and they actually delve into their full story about why Jamie and, you know, like-minded people wanted to start an organization where people could find outlets to help them deal with mental health issues. Because, you know, there's a really moving story that he wrote about this girl that he had met who had had a lot of different problems. And one of them was self-harm. And it was his experience and dealing with that and seeing her and her emotions and her pain and the things that she went through, that made him really want to create a place where people like her and like myself could turn to see what their options are. Mm-hmm. So you can go to write Love on Her Arms and all these different kinds of places now. But that one was kind of the first and biggest one to come out of, or come out side by side with the emo movement. You can turn to these places and they'll give you resources, locally, nationally, you know, things that can help you get through a tough time.
Right, right. A little more focused than, say, like suicide prevention, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, when we talk about suicide prevention, to me, that kind of term doesn't really get to the heart of the matter. It's more like just connecting on a human level, you know, person to person. It's not necessarily, you know, something that you call a hotline and you get a Band-Aid and, you know, everything's good to go. There's a lot more work that goes into it than that.
And this organization takes it a step further, then, is what you're saying.
Yes, they do. And I know, just as a fan going to Warped Tour for many years, I would always see their tent there. They were always, you know, giving out bracelets, like taking donations and like talking to people, educating them about depression and mental health and these kinds of things. So they're always active.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, a lot of people might say, well, you know, I mean, these are, you know, people who have problems and I don't have problems and I don't really need to concern myself with that. And, you know, I just think that modern life and its machinations and its structure lends itself to these issues that become more prominent, especially with younger people. And there needs to be some outlets to alleviate, at least alleviate some of the situation, if not remove it entirely. I'm not sure if we could get to that without, you know, huge structural change. But an organization like To Write Love on Her Arms is certainly a great step forward.
Right. And you actually bring up a good point that I would love to discuss further, that people who don't necessarily have these quote unquote problems, they don't understand and they don't try to understand people who do have them. So that's actually a core reason, I think, as to why the emo genre in the first place became something that was, you know, mocked at the same time that it was promoted, because, you know, there was a very, I'm an insider, you're an outsider mentality. And I think, you know, we can see that today in all manifestations of our society in all aspects. I mean, you look at politics. I mean, emo has nothing to do with politics, but you look at the political sphere today and you look at the country today. And I think everybody could agree that the main reason that we're such a divided country is that people aren't willing to have open conversations and understand one another.
No, it tends to be that those without, you know, a particular problem want to treat those who have that as some sort of contagion.
Right.
And therefore they want to, you know, get away from it as quickly as possible, as opposed to facing it and trying to do something about it.
Right. And, emo music makes you face everything. Emo music,
yeah, is literally in your face.
Yeah, emo music is uncomfortable for a lot of people to listen to for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. So how did you put the book together and how long have you been working on it?
I mean, speaking of timing, it really kind of lucked
out. You're going to tell me since you were 13, right?
No. So about a year or so ago, I was thinking to myself, you know, nobody's really written a book about this, an oral history about this. And I had read, American Hardcore, by Stephen Blush. I had read, an oral history of punk rock, Please Kill Me.
Legs McNeil.
Legs McNeil. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about those kinds of books and how nobody had done that for emo yet. Then I kind of, I shelved that idea for a while, going about my daily grind. And then out of nowhere, one day, someone from Mango Publishing reached out to me. Apparently they'd stalked my writing on the internet long enough to think that they liked me. And they proposed, would you want to be the person to write a book about emo and like indie and stuff like that? And it was just this weird cosmic timing where, out of the blue, someone came and asked me if I wanted to write the thing that I initially set out to write. So, it gave me the kick in the ass to do what I needed to do. And I think about a year it took me.
Okay. All right. And you conducted a lot of interviews along the way.
Yeah. Being a music journalist for years provided me with a lot of great connections. Some of these people I'd already talked to them before.
Right.
All I had to really do was reach out to friends, and someone knew somebody else, and it was very organic.
All right, so let's get into your book. It seems in some ways the emo genre kind of grew up alongside the internet by both being born out of the 90s.
Yeah, so you have this new youth punk rock movement that someone is going to call emo, and then you have the internet coming out in its like very primitive form at the same time. And so you have teenagers, these angsty teenagers who are looking to get their voice out, and then you have an internet connection where you find message boards and people with similar thoughts and feelings to you, and those things come together for something truly phenomenal.
Yeah, because prior generations had to search high and low to find the new thing, if you will. Let's take the punk movement, for example, of which I'm pretty familiar with and grew up with. There were fanzines and literally, you either wrote to somebody and they sent you one in the mail, or, the bands that came through town left a couple of zines that you then gave them other copies. And, it was like traveling by stagecoach, if you will. And now, you guys in this 90s era have this new tool, which is, instantaneous. You can share information with, right?
Yeah. At first, the emo music genre or movement, however you want to say it, it was very much like that 70s punk DIY vibe where, the people would know other bands simply by going to different houses in New Jersey where they would host these, house shows or basement shows, and same thing in New York and parts of Long Island. And word of mouth was really initially the way that it gained its strength. And then it just skyrocketed beyond belief when the internet came full bloom.
Yeah. So now to use a little bit of a quote from one of your interviewees in the book, A Rose by Any Other Name, I have to ask you to give me the expert's definition on what stands as a quote unquote emo band.
Well, in the introduction, I actually say what I think represents an emo band. And it is funny because there were a few people who I interviewed, and their interviews are in that book, that say that they don't understand what emo means, even if they're part of an emo band, because to them, they've heard so many different bands described as emo. But, sonically, there's, I think the vocal is very unique, and it's not a quality vocal, you know, but it's not exactly a generic punk vocal either. You know, it's not just angry. It's something that's desperate and something that's a little bit more vulnerable at the same time that it's being aggressive. Mm-hmm. And musically it was typically pretty minimalistic. But it could be really slow songs. It could be really fast songs. But, you know, it really did come out of what Adam Lazara called teenage poetry in one of his early Taking Back Sunday songs. He talks about, you know, bad teenage poetry. And to me, that's like the perfect way to describe emo music.
Yeah, so it's definitely more melodic than punk, and it's expressing inner feelings lyrically, and then performing a range of emotions, as opposed to, you know, strictly anger or, you know, fuck the man and, you know, society sucks and all that, which you get a lot in the punk side of things. So there's far more feeling in the lyrics and in the performance of. While the band itself, but you get that a lot from the vocalist, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the vocalist is literally the mouthpiece for the entire band, and you see it not just in emo and screamo music, you see it in hardcore music too. If you were to go to a hardcore show, the vocalist jumps right in there with the fans. You know, they understand that they really aren't any different than the people that they're singing to. The only difference is that they have a mic.
So they're really breaking the fourth wall here.
Oh yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's set the stage for this new kind of sound that's growing out of the 90s punk scene. So how does it begin? I think like Sunny Day Real Estate, Taking Back Sunday, Rites of Spring, Jimmy Eat World. Is that put me in the right world here?
Yep, you're right in there.
So did it start with, I think Rites of Spring is actually starts in the 80s, isn't that right?
Yeah, so a lot of people, when I was doing interviews for this book, a lot of the subjects that were part of these big emo and screamo bands in the late 90s and early 2000s, they cited Ian MacKaye and his bands, you know, Minor Threat, Embrace, Fugazi.
Yeah, and Fugazi, yeah.
And as a main influence, and Rites of Spring was right there too, next to Fugazi. And it's interesting because not a lot of people would suspect that a genre like this, which takes so much flack for being, you know, feminine or vulnerable or, you know, something like that, would stem out of hardcore, and not just hardcore, but political DC hardcore with Ian MacKaye, who's like one of the biggest legends you'll find in that genre. So,
oh, yeah.
And you know, he was even confused when I asked him to interview for it. He had no idea how he was related to the emo genre, but, you know, everybody else that I talked to are like, yeah, he's the granddaddy of emo. So, it was this kind of thing that I found out where it came from just by talking to different people who they themselves weren't sure where it came from. You know, you find the truth within the different stories. So,
yeah, I mean, sure, we could go back and pick various influencers. You know, The Cure comes to mind, an introspective artist, Robert Smith, and the fact of taking an aggressive, very aggressive form of rock and roll, punk, and then, you know, giving it some subtleties, some shades of gray, and then adding in, you know, these delicate topics, as we discussed here a few minutes ago, that shouldn't be, but definitely at that time were taboo to be discussed openly. And therefore, I think you also then have a target on your back of for those that embrace that, you know, oh, well, you know, you're like you enjoy this
these dark, desperate feelings, and therefore you gravitate towards entertainment that that fuels that. And I don't think that's the case here. I think you're seeing more of a self-help, almost a medication by what the bands are providing and what the audience is giving back. Because as we know, there's a feedback loop that goes on between an artist and the audience in a public performance, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's not just me. There are so many people. You can easily find it on internet forums, or if you just talk to someone who enjoys this music, a lot of people say, this music saved my life, or yeah, this band saved my life, especially with, you know, we were talking earlier, My Chemical Romance. I can't tell you how many people there are out there that say that My Chemical Romance saved them. And, you know, it's a debated thing to say. Some people say that, well, nothing else can save you. You save yourself, which is somewhat true. But, you know,
yeah,
for
but
people,
you're still taking in, you know, stimulus, that you know, you reflect on, and, you know, you then, you know, make a decision either through door A or through door B. And if the stimulus is a positive one, regardless of how it's presented, then that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So, I think almost everyone who has participated in an emo show or has been in a band or who has, you know, done anything in that sphere, they will be able to tell you about how much it positively impacted them, which will surprise a lot of people who aren't familiar with it because it seems so negative.
Yeah, from an outsider, you know, but that's happened numerous times through the history of rock and roll. There's always inevitably some backlash. I mean, you know, remember John Lennon famously, you know, put into an interview that the Beatles at that moment happened to be, you know, bigger than Jesus. He wasn't comparing himself to Jesus, but, you know, evangelicals in America didn't take it that way. And they all pointed the finger and said, oh, you know, you're awful and horrible. And, you know, so without understanding the delicacy of what Lennon was trying to say. And the same thing could be said about this music. I mean, from an outsider's perspective, yeah, it all seems dark and depressing. And, you know, why do I want to make myself even more depressed than I already am? But that's not really what you get when you, you know, delve deeper into this genre, right?
Right. What you find instead is common ground with somebody. You find common ground with a stranger through their sounds and their lyrics. And, you know, at the end of the day, just having them say something to you through your headphones could save your life. And that's what happened with me.
Yeah, it's the music itself, the lyrical content, but it's also the aesthetic, the camaraderie, the social nature of it. I mean, this has been going on since you know, the Who and the Mods in 1965. You know, every generation finds its unique sort of way of existence that wants to get out of the real world as they find themselves in. And they invent this thing to help them get from point A to point B.
Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting that you brought up religion, because in some ways it is very much like a religion. You know, it's something that, like you said, brings people together, and something that exists outside themselves as well as inside themselves that they can devote themselves to. Like, I personally am an atheist, so I don't go to church. I don't do any of those things. But to me, music, particularly emo music, felt like my church. Going to those shows felt like going to church. That was the only God that I needed, because that was the thing that gave me solace when I needed it.
Yeah, it's been said many times, and you know, the music, and especially this emotionally free
music we call rock and roll, and it'll all be rolled into what is called the rock and roll age as we find ourselves a couple hundred years in the future, that, you know, it provided some of the same symbolic and cultural references that, say, you know, a church religious experience would be. I know I've had plenty of religious experiences in rock and roll, and I'm sure you have as well.
Mm-hmm. And when I talked to William Goldsmith from Sunny Day Real Estate, who's also the drummer for Foo Fighters for a bit, he said that it was a spiritual moment when he got an encore for the first time. You know, people wanted Sunny Day Real Estate to come back out on stage. He said that was a very spiritual moment that he'd never experienced. And it's that kind of moment that we cling to whenever we go to a show like that.
Right, right. So, you know, as we kind of, there's a theme and a thread beginning to expose itself here. And that's the mental health side of things seems to be, you know, an opportunity for the artist in this world to express some of this hopelessness that's commonly found in teens who aren't in the, let us say, popular circles. And therefore, these artists are speaking for their audience, right?
Right, because they are their audience, you know, they identify with each other. Not to say that every person who listens and likes emo music and makes emo music is that way. I know plenty of people who've never had a problem with depression, but love this kind of music. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, it's about keeping an open mind to those experiences that other people might be going through. And even within the same band, you know, when I talk to, Garrett from Senses Fail, who was the guitarist and founding member and did a lot of the songwriting on the musical end of it, the, you know, instrumental end of it. He said he never dealt with depression or anxiety or anything like that. But famously, Buddy Nielsen, who is the vocalist and lyricist for Senses Fail, is, you know, deeply entrenched in things like addictive behavior and alcoholism and, you know, depression, all those kinds of things. So even within the same band, you have two different life experiences, but it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the thing about the emo genre is the, you know, wearing this on your shirt sleeve here, you are, you know, writing about, you know, what is, as we've discussed, a kind of a taboo subject, maybe less so today. And maybe some of that's because of, you know, this music being an exposure to the world. But, you know, before it, that kind of was not really something that most rock and roll artists delved into, right?
Right, but I would always like to say that rock music and punk music of any type is always protesting or challenging something. And, you know, in 70s punk, they were challenging status quo, you know, social political issues, things like that. In emo music, whether this was their intention or not, they're challenging the notion that you can't talk about these types of things. So their middle finger to the world wasn't, you know,
fuck again, the man. It was, I got problems and you're going to know about it.
Yeah, exactly. When everybody wanted to pretend like there are no problems.
Right, 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 right. All right, so I think it's fair to say that ground zero geographically was the New York, New Jersey area with bands like My Chem, Taking Back Sunday, and also a few other American geographies that you get into. But my question is interestingly, there's not a British version. Why do you think that is?
I think like every genre of music, there's always some international take on it. There's always a different culture that, you know, has their own underground. But the same way that, you know, rock and roll kind of became part of the American identity, even though, you know, the Beatles were from the UK and the Rolling Stones, there became a certain brand of American rock. And even with punk, there was this whole debate of, you know, was real punk in the UK or was real punk in New York City? Which yeah. I can watch SLC Punk, the movie, you know, any day of the week. It's definitely recommended. But with emo music, I don't know. It's not like it didn't cross over internationally, because there were a lot of fans internationally, but there was something about this time and place that was very conducive to this kind of music.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe, you know, look, you know, Americans are rather uncouth and are more than willing to stand on a street corner and you know, be rude and obnoxious and express themselves maybe in a freer way than other cultures are. And you know, this like we stated, you know, we're you know, a lot of the lyrical content is of this, you know, a taboo subject that is not meant to be discussed in polite society. And here these guys, and let's face it, it is mostly guys, are out there, you know, screaming it in your face on record and live. And that may not translate to maybe some other cultures that, interact differently.
Yeah, definitely. We're absolutely nowhere near as polite as probably anybody in the world.
If you've done any international travel, yes, you find that common, don't you?
Yeah, I regret sometimes having to say that I'm an American, and I'm like, no, not like that. Not like
not that kind of American. No, yeah. No, sorry.
But yeah, I definitely agree with you.
Yeah, it's just interesting that there was not a British version. I mean, if it comes out of the 90s, you have the Britpop scene in England, you know, taking fruit there. In the 2000s, it's funny, there wasn't, you know, some sort of British band that kind of fit in with some of the bands that we've already discussed today. And it just, I don't know, it just never really happened. I just found that as I read through your book, you know, I kept thinking, oh, I'm missing something. And she's going to expose this thing that I was unaware of. And after reading the book, went looking myself, and it's just not there. So, but
I think also it's easier to understand if you also think about hardcore. Hardcore is a very American genre. You'll
very
find
true. Yeah, that New also York, is primarily American, and you don't see a lot of that in Britain.
Right, New York hardcore is its own staple of things. You know, the LA hardcore. They have, you know, all these different brands, but they're very centralized in a particular location. And that is because there's a sense of community that you draw from this music, from hardcore, from emo. There's a sense of local community that is very important.
Yeah, yeah. As you discovered yourself, growing up in New Jersey, you know, you gravitated to these local bands and you rode the ride with them from underground to whatever success they achieved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, all right. So, you know, you brought this up and you bring it up in the book, and some of your interviewees bring it up. And, you know, I I'm trying to find this key here. You've opened this door for me, and I'm kind of now I'm in this room that I'm a little unfamiliar with. I mean, some of it's, you know, I see some commonalities, and, you know, I think I would fit in. Okay. But it's a little unusual and unique for me. And so what I found was, this interesting piece where, you know, why do you think so many bands refuse to embrace the label of being emo? I like Thomas Mullin's quote that, emo's both revered and hated at the same time. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So I'm trying to square that circle, if you will.
Well, I dedicate at least an entire chapter to that in the book. I think you would have a hard time getting an answer to that question just asking the bands themselves. I mean, I did. I had a difficult time getting some people to claim it as something positive, and that's something that's their own. And, you know, it's juxtaposed with this notion that getting called emo is a term used by outsiders to kind of make fun of you.
Yeah.
But
isn't punk? I mean, you know, the origination of the word punk is, you know, a bottom in a British prison. You know, that's the, you know, a homosexual in a British prison is where the term punk comes from. But unlike emo, you know, the punkers at first were like, oh, fuck that, I'm not that. And then they were like, well, fuck you, it's mine, I own it. So now, now punk means what I want it to mean. And I found it interesting that the emo guys, they never really, it doesn't seem like they ever really, I mean, I'd say they do now, but at its moment, as it's happening, they don't, it's like they want to run away from the term, even though, you know, I just feel like they should own it, right?
I agree, they should own it, but I think why a lot of people still don't is because, like the music itself, it's very complex and multidimensional. So you don't have this one simple, straightforward, okay, I'm a punk, so fuck you. It's more complex than that because you have all these different kinds of layered emotions in there. So when trying to classify it as one thing, you kind of run into problems because it's not just one thing. It's a lot of different types of things.
Well, I also think that, you know, again, reading from some of the interviewees and most of them are male, and knowing that time, and, you know, growing up in an American male myself, you know, there's a line that, you know, you're not allowed to cross, which exposes your emotionalism. And let's face it, the word emo itself is a shortening of emotional or emotions. And and that, you know, while I think would, you know, greatly increase your fan base, especially your feminine fan base, there's like this, I want to just put my toe over it, but I don't want to just jump completely into the pool with a lot of these guys.
Yeah, and we talk about toxic masculinity in the book. Yeah. It's a subject that organically came up when I did a lot of these interviews, because, like you said, quote unquote, boys don't cry. If you're a man, or whatever society says a man is supposed to be, you're supposed to be tough. You're not supposed to show your emotions. But actually, no.
That makes it worse. I mean, yeah. Then you take it out on other people and things like that.
Right. And, you know, then you have bigger, you know, larger societal problems that come from those internal problems that are getting ignored. So what emo did, and what these guys so bravely talked about, was that it's okay to feel the emotions that you have. Actually, it's better to feel the emotions that you have, and it doesn't make you any less of a man because of it. And in my opinion, it makes you much more of a man if you're able to face your emotions and deal with them. It makes you much more of a person. Forget man or woman. It makes you more of a person.
Yeah.
To deal with those things than to shy away from them and pretend like they don't exist.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's face it. The society, our American culture has changed quite drastically in the last 20 years, and the acceptance of you know, marginalized people more and more. And let's hope it continues that way. I think we're in a tough spot at the moment, but you know, for the last 20 years, the arc of history has been towards justice for a lot of marginalized people, which has allowed people to open up and express themselves more freely. And I find it interesting that this music arrives right at this time when this discussion is being had by society in the large.
Yeah, I think it's like what you said before, it's about being a feedback loop. So emo was kind of a symptom of the larger culture, and the larger culture then became a symptom of emo. So yeah. You can't really untie that knot.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to guess you are a Tolkien fan because you reference him when discussing the term from where this music came from and the title of your book, From the Basement. So let's discuss that.
Yeah, sure. Nobody's actually asked me about that yet. So the phrase cellar door is celebrated in the literary community because a lot of literary professionals like Tolkien have stated that it's the most beautiful phrase in the English language. That's actually also referenced in the film Donnie Darko starring Jake Gyllenhaal. And, you know, people, when they talked about it in a literary sense, you know, they talk about the sound of the word and how they go together. But to me, it's much more about the idea behind the cellar door. What do you access when you open the cellar door? What's down there? It's dark. People don't normally go there. But it happens to be exactly where you find this kind of music coming from.
Yeah. So you're not, I mean, a lot of these shows were, or these bands began, especially if you're from the East Coast where basements are prominent, kind of grew out of the real true underground, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that you would literally have these shows in the, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, these little house parties where you would be introduced to various bands, you know, which were primarily done in these little basements.
Yeah, it was definitely much stronger back in the day. The local scene was really thriving, but it still happens today. I mean, I myself have hosted a couple house shows, basement shows. You know, my friends are in bands and they do their own shows at their friends' houses sometimes. I actually just went to a Halloween party where my friend and his band did a Misfits cover show.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So it's still part of the culture here, just not as intensely as it was when emo first started rising.
Yeah, yeah. I also got the sense that the records were one thing and meant to be listened to almost on a personal journey, which in the age of iPods and earbuds makes a lot of sense to me. But the live shows were a completely different experience, and those were meant to be very social.
Right. It's really interesting because there is a contrast there. And
Which you don't see in previous music genres. You know, it's very, you know, music used to be, you know, hey, you get a record and you share it with your friends. And, you know, you had speakers and therefore it was, you know, out in the world. But nowadays with the, you know, the advent of the iPod and earbuds, it's a different experience, especially listening to records. But the live show is still the same. It's still, you know, like we've discussed, it's like going to church.
Yeah. And it's an interesting point that you bring up with the earbuds, because it does make for a very individualized listening experience in a genre that itself talks about the individual and internalized feelings. So you really, I mean, I remember walking through hallways in high school with my earbuds in and trying to block out the rest of the world and only hear this music. And, you go to a live show and you go for a different reason. You go not just to see the band, but you go to experience that feeling of connection with a larger group of people and to know that you really are not alone in whatever you're feeling.
Right. So by the time we get into the 2000s, you know, it's begun to formalize into something. I'm not sure if people were calling it emo right at the moment, but I think Jimmy Eat World with the song "The Middle" is kind of like the first emo pop song. You know, the crossover, the one that kind of really solidifies this as something, and you know, probably makes people wake up, you know, outside of the underground. And pay attention, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there even are people that I interviewed for the book that say in there that, you know, Jimmy Eat World might be to blame for the popularization of emo. But Jimmy Eat World are absolutely crucial. The middle is probably, if you ask any sincere fan, their worst fucking song, as is what happens to usually turn up on the radio. But it was a very kind of mainstream way to access the deeper parts and the deeper cuts of Jimmy Eat World songs.
Yeah. Okay, so by the mid-decade, it seems the genre kind of hits its stride, and at the same time, it kind of seems to peak rather quickly, and we'll get into that in a bit. But let's talk about this moment where I personally remember this, and that's My Chemical Romance's I'm Not Okay showing up on MTV. And the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, these guys are going to be giant. And sure enough, they did become the biggest emo band. I think we can all agree on that, as far as record sales and ticket sales are concerned. You have this sort of happening, and it appears to be this first decade of this new century, this first sort of new genre that people can latch themselves onto.
Yeah, and in my book, I line that up pretty side by side with the evolution of the internet and, you know, the ease of access to things. Because when emo first started and it was underground, late 90s, the internet was like around, but it wasn't where it was a few years later, where all of a sudden you could get information at lightning speed. Everybody was on the internet.
And you had things like MySpace available.
Yeah. MySpace, Pure Volume, you know, illegal downloading software, which was both good and bad for the genre, because I think it made the big bands like My Chem and The Used, it made them arena stars. You know, they would perform in arenas.
Yeah.
Then after the exposure, then you kind of get the financial drawback of, well, everybody's downloading it for
my
free.
Record for free. So,
So at the same time that it exploded because of the internet, it also kind of imploded because of the internet.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe things, you know, just move that much quicker. Because the information can disseminate itself much quicker. The lag time disappears. A band can go from nothing to, you know, the top of the pop, in a matter of months, if not weeks, these days. And we're just seeing the beginnings of that. And this genre is almost like the petri dish for all of that happening, right?
Yeah, it was kind of the first road test, I think, of how the internet affects music.
Yeah, good and bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I have to ask this a little side, because I don't know, but there appears to have been a falling out or a disagreement between two bands, Taking Back Sunday and The Brand New. So can you fill us in on that?
Yes. I can't get into terrible detail.
Because your book doesn't. It's, you mention it, it's there. And I was like, there's something more here than going on. I mean, let's set the stage here. So, these two bands kind of grew up with each other. In fact, I think some of the members are childhood friends, and that there was something that happened, and then they started, putting this into their act or their shows and their records, and this became a feud, right?
Yeah. So the reason that it's vague, both in general and in the book, is because the members of both bands have intentionally kept it pretty vague. But what's known in, you know, kind of public knowledge is that it had something to do with a girl. There was like a disagreement, or, you know, a kind of like, oh, you're my friend, but you stabbed me in the back. And that whole thing led to back and forths between Taking Back Sunday and Brand New, who, you know, at that point had parted ways. And it was a pretty significant rift in the local, you know, New York, New Jersey scene, because you kind of had to pick a side at some point.
Oh, the fans themselves had to pick a side.
Yeah, they did.
It was the Jets and the Sharks, huh?
Jets and the Giants, kind
no,
of.
No, I was going with the West Side Story, the Sharks and the Jets, to keep it musical. But sure, football teams will work.
Well, I mean, I bring up the Jets and the Giants because they also split this area in half.
That's
so
right. That is right. That is right. So so I take it the fans, you know, bickered amongst themselves as well then.
Yeah. There was this kind of sense that you had to be a Taking Back Sunday fan or a Brand New fan. I came a little bit after that. I was a little too young at the time.
Oh, so you didn't have to pick sides.
Right. I personally like Taking Back Sunday a lot better. I also heard them first, but I can appreciate certain Brand New songs. The thing I will say is that in recent years, it has come out that there are accusations against Brand New vocalist and main songwriter Jesse Lacey, you know, sexual assault allegations. I don't know, you know, the official outcomes of those accusations, if they were ruled on in court, whatever, but I do know that that has become public knowledge now, so a lot of people can't even go back and listen to Brand New records in the same way.
All right, another fascinating story, and I know for those anybody, you know, even remotely familiar with the emo scene knows this story, but a lot of our audience doesn't, and that is the creation of My Chemical Romance after 9/11. So for those who are unaware, can you tell their origin story?
So it's kind of become emo lore at this point. And it's especially meaningful to people like myself who were in the area when 9/11 happened. You know, I was a kid, in New Jersey, you know, going to school, and all of a sudden one day, people's parents started showing up and taking them out of class, and nobody would say anything. There was no explanation for what happened. And then, you know, I heard that the Twin Towers had fallen, and for me that was really hard, because I mean, I was a little kid and my mom was stuck in New York City. She worked in New York City, and I had no way of contacting her, and I didn't know if she was coming home or not. She finally came home at the end of the night. But at the same time that happened, you know, Gerard Way, the vocalist for My Chem, he wasn't a little kid like me. He was starting his adult life, and he was in the area. He was working doing animation in the city.
Yeah, Cartoon Network. Yeah.
Yeah, and he experienced it pretty firsthand, and it was one of those moments that immediately reminds you that life is too short. And he turned around and did exactly what he wanted to, which was start My Chemical Romance. And the first batch of songs that came out had, one of the singles was called, Skylines and Turnstiles. And it is based off of 9/11 and his
personal experience,
personal experiences and recollections of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it informed Gerard Way as much as it did for any American like yourself, coming of age, on that day.
Yeah, it definitely did. And I've talked to, Buddy Nielsen before, the vocalist of Senses Fail. I've talked to him for other assignments that I've done. And, he said that he was very much influenced by that, and that there was some kind of undercurrent of emotion that, you know, that event helped push.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, for all Americans, it's a dark day. But you know, for young people who, you know, don't have an understanding of, you know, the whys and hows, you know, it's just, you know, a terrible event. And the you know, the fear of it continuing was very palpable, at the time. You know, anybody who had, any kind of understanding of the situation that we found ourselves in knew that, you know, this was coordinated. It was obviously just the first of what you know, our new enemy had hoped to be more, and so the fear was palpable in everything you did. You know, I had to cross bridges and myself, you know, get into high rises within days of the event, and you know, and you know, constantly being aware of my surroundings, because you know, who's to say that it wouldn't happen here. And I can't imagine how difficult that would be for, you know, somebody of your age, you know, just becoming aware of the world and now having to deal with something like this. And the same thing with Gerard.
Yeah. No matter what age you are, it would transform you in some way. And for him, it, you know, he turned it into something positive, which ended up being the greatest emo music ever.
Yeah. And which gets us probably to the peak, which, you know, I think would be now. So there are some other bands that get up into that stratosphere, right? You know, I'd say Fall Out Boy, The Used, you know, maybe even Coheed and Cambria experienced some success around this time. And this is the latter half of the decade. But I think the ultimate peak, you know, let us say the Led Zeppelin, you know, the Beatles type of thing, is My Chemical Romance's The Black Parade, right?
Definitely. Are people who might argue you on which album it was that did it for them. Personally, from the very beginning, I liked Three Cheers, but Black Parade was that record that really solidified My Chem, not just in their own scene, but in the mainstream, because Welcome to the Black Parade, everybody saw that music video, you know, everybody knew that song.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of other hits that came off that album as well, and they were, you know, on their way to superstardom, and then it's funny because it doesn't last very long. You know, I'm glad to hear that they are coming back, and I do think that there is this resurgence that is going on. And you know, you must have, you know, your spider senses must have felt this resurgence, whether you knew it or not. And you know, your book is showing up in a very timely fashion here. But it's a very interesting piece of history, that rock and roll history, that I'm trying to figure out is that, you know, normally these genres have this, you know, 5 to 10 year arc where you know, they're ruling the pop chart scene, and I think we're lucky if we have 2 or 3 years with this where this is, you know, being considered. Now, let's face it, we live in a world, and especially in the last 20 years, of a much more fragmented music scene, which, you know, didn't exist in some of the previous iterations of rock and roll. But I am interested in why it, you know, took a little bit to come. That's normal, to get into the mainstream. But once it arrives, it does only for this very short period of time, and then it kind of burns out very quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's a direct result of illegal downloading and CD sales crashing.
Yeah. Again, the internet,
so,
right?
Yeah, so, you know, if you talk to a publicist at that time or like a label head at that time, they'll tell you that all of a sudden the money wasn't there. Yeah. You know, it wasn't sustainable in that same capacity anymore. And that was kind of the last time you really heard rock on the radio, at least mainstream radio channels.
Yeah, the last rock and roll album to reach number one was American Idiot in 2006. It's been that long. I know.
Yeah.
So I think both of us would agree that a new format or genre of guitar-driven, you know, self-contained band writing, recording, and performing their own music, it just hasn't risen to the popularity of this genre that you've written about. This was it. This was the last hurrah.
It was in the context of mainstream pop culture. Now, as you said, the overarching rock umbrella is fragmented into innumerable amounts of subgenres and things like that. So you do have these bands, these metal bands, these hardcore bands that have millions and millions of followers. You just don't hear about it on, you know, your main radio station. It's different now, but rock is definitely not dead by any means. It's just somewhere else.
Yeah, as we like to say, rock's not dead. It just smells funny. It's out there. And yeah, I constantly say that, there's plenty of good rock music out and certainly live these days. And the record industry has made a comeback. There does seem to be some momentum in the music world, which is great for everybody. But to your point, it's not in the cultural zeitgeist. I have a theory that, guitar driven rock and roll is a very 20th century type of sound. I mean, hell, the electric guitar itself is a 20th century invention. It sounds like the industrial 20th century, and we don't live in that world anymore. We live in the world of computers, the digital age, and the computer itself is the primary instrument of music creation today, right?
Yeah, which is why you see a lot of people who were in this genre, they do cross over. They cross over from this genre to electronic genres. And the best example of that is Skrillex. Who, if anybody didn't know it already, Skrillex, Sonny Moore, was actually in From First to Last, which is another major name in emo screamo music. And he shifted and became the biggest dubstep sensation, the first real dubstep sensation, I think.
Yeah.
So, these people are talented in many facets of the word, but...
Well, everybody's got a side hustle, right?
Yeah.
So kind of getting towards the end of this and seeing this, this music fade out, at the end of the aughts, the decade there, a lot of people point fingers. And one of them, as you talk about in your book, is the emo fashion, skinny jeans, choppy bangs, studded belts, guy liner, etc. I don't know. I mean, sure, that's one potential finger that you might point at, but I tend to agree with your friend Natasha Van Duser that this was what the audience used to identify themselves and not necessarily how the bands themselves dressed, right?
Yeah, I agree with her take as well, but I can also see the band members themselves, like their point of view, became not that the fashion damaged the music or the quality of the music, but it distracted. So by the time that it reached mainstream, as it did with My Chemical Romance, it had evolved to something totally different than, bands like Mineral were. Mineral was an emo band that came much earlier and is vastly different in sound and appearance than My Chemical Romance, but there is an evolution there.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, look, all genres create these identifiers. It's a uniform, if you will. As I brought up earlier, there's the Who and the Mods. you know, and that was a look so that the audience could identify itself. And then it's really the band members weren't the ones that were inventing this. They were stealing it from the audience. and, you know, this is the way things go. I just don't see pointing the finger at a fashion statement as being the reason for the demise. I think you're on to something more that, look, this is part of the internet culture. I think the demise of MySpace probably had more to do with it than, you know, somebody's chopped bangs and guyliner. And that the music industry itself was going through potentially death throes at the time that this music rose to prominence. And, you know, those two things, you know, were difficult to navigate for any genre that would have existed, including somebody like the Beatles. So, you know, it ran its course a little bit quicker. And also, you know, as we said, you know, it's been 15 years since, you know, a guitar-driven rock band has had a number one album. And maybe, you know, maybe that instrumentation and that, you know, that sort of setup, you know, has run its course. You know, I spent a lot of time digging into rock and roll history, and I've noticed a big difference between American and English rock and roll artists. And it's something I brought up a little bit earlier, but I want to explore a little bit deeper, and that it's Americans so desperately want to retain utter authenticity, while the Englishman understands that they are entertainers first. I think Americans sometimes get hung up on this, and therefore they pigeonhole themselves and can't grow as artists. It seems to me the emo bands took this very seriously and therefore kind of boxed themselves in. Is that a fair assessment?
I think in some ways, yes. There was a huge focus on remaining authentic, as always is the problem in anything related to punk rock. You worry about selling out.
Yeah.
But that can mean a number of different things. For some people, selling out simply means you got popular. And I think that's just a total waste of time to think about. But, you know, in my opinion, selling out doesn't matter, you know, how many record sales you have, how many people are coming to your shows. It's a matter of whether you can keep the sincerity behind the music while you're advancing ahead. And, you know, some people could, some people couldn't.
Yeah, unlike other monikers of rock and roll genres, it seems like the players themselves never felt comfortable in their skins, or maybe they kind of felt like they aged out.
I think aging out might be the more
likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So now in 2019, like all things, the cyclical, and there seems to be this resurgence for the emo scene. There's things like Emo Night that you can find in most major cities. I think there's even a tour that that goes around. And like we said at the beginning, My Chemical Romance is coming back. You know, it's like, I guess what I want to say is that overall, taken as a whole, there's this good songwriting. And as long as there's good songwriting, that is the thing that remains permanent. You'll never get rid of that. The fashion, the goofiness that might appear, that all kind of goes away, and you're left with the songs, and those are forever, right?
Definitely. And nobody can take that personal experience away from you of relating to that song. You'll always remember the first time you heard a My Chemical Romance song. You'll always remember the first time you heard a Taking Back Sunday song, or any one of those bands, any underground band that I haven't named that deserves to be named. You'll always remember them, and hopefully it'll remain part of you as more than just a bit of nostalgia.
Yeah, you know, music is the language of the universe. And, you know, each generation just has its own spin on that language, and they retain that for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is next for you, Taylor?
The next thing for me is just to get more people to listen and listen closely. You know, I would love to get this book into the hands of as many people as possible, because I think the genre is worthwhile. And I think that even if you weren't a fan of it coming in, you'll find it pretty fascinating regardless.
Well, I think you did a good job of, you know, exposing this as something more than, you know, this blip in rock and roll history, that there's far more depth to it than one might first think, that it actually brings a lot of interesting, introspective and emotionally deep lyrical content to it, and, you know, a music that expresses itself as equally to the words. And I think that's the takeaway that I get from the book.
Well, I'm glad you can take that away, and I'm glad that you enjoyed it. It really means a lot.
Well, Taylor Markarian, thanks so much for being with us on Deeper Digs in Rock today.
Thank you for taking the time to talk about From the Basement.
Wow. Thank you for the education, Taylor Markarian. As I said in the intro, I had only a passing acquaintance with the emo scene, but I did get a chance to see the Black Parade tour, Mike Hem's big arena touring year. But that was my experience in most of the emo music. So I really enjoyed talking with her. I uncovered something new. Well, new to me anyway, during our deeper dig today. When this podcast began 5 years ago, we defined the rock and roll era as mid-50s to mid-90s and suggested that the last great genre was grunge. And you know what? I'm rethinking that. Now it seems to me like the story does continue, at least into the first decade of this new millennium. I do know this for sure. I now have a much better understanding and appreciation of emo rock. Once again, the author is Taylor Markarian, and the book is called From the Basement, The History of Emo Music and How It Changed Society. I'm Christian Swain, and this has been Deeper Digs in Rock. But real quick before I go, I also want to give a quick shout-out to my niece, Sydney Ann, for helping me out with some of these bands that are name-checked throughout the book, just so I would get a thorough education. I think Sydney and Taylor would be fast friends and end up in the mosh pit together at any emo concert. Thanks again, of course, to Taylor Markarian for stopping by, and thank you for listening. And as always, keep up the rockin'!
Your lipstick is colored up by the angel. I know exactly what goes on.
Face down, down across your floor.
We're just so long at this exploded. And we'll use it.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at the RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.